This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Science fiction and fantasy stories that once seemed impossible to adapt to the big screen have become box office hits in recent years. And in his essay this month on our website, WVXU.org, film critic T.T. Stern-Enzi writes that some of the new adaptations on streaming services are finding ways to expand upon favorite stories, and some of them highlight some of the characters within them that have been overlooked in the past. T.T. Stern-Enzi joins me now to talk about some of the newest adaptations to hit the small screen and how some are having more success than others. Welcome back, T.T.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Always fun to have you. We're talking about adaptations today, but many of these are adaptations that take stories or series in kind of a different direction. They explore characters that have been overlooked in some of the big feature films. Are you glad to see filmmakers and showrunners kind of moving in that direction?
Well, what I'm really glad about is this idea now that I think we have a different understanding of how to tell, you know, multifaceted kinds of stories. And you can start them on the big screen, or you can start them on the, you know, on the small screen. I'm getting to the point where I won't say television anymore exactly, because I don't really know what that means.
Right.
But streaming is kind of the thing now. But yeah, I like this idea that we have recognized that, yes, you can do, for instance, you know, a feature film or two, you know, that has, you know, is based on a property that has a number of titles that you can choose from. And then you can sort of say, well, if we do the films here, now we can take the time to explore a character or a particular situation in that universe and bring it to a streaming service where you can get 8 to 10 episodes and spend more time in the world. But then also know that now that you've done that, you can jump back to the big screen again and continue telling stories in that world. So that's really fascinating, because, again, it's an easy way to, in essence, prop up both sides of that market. Because we've been hearing for years that, you know, the film and box office world is dying. We're starting to hear little rumbles about how maybe streaming isn't going to survive in the way that it has as well. So if both of them have potential problems that they have to address, then why not kind of figure out a way to marry the two?
Can this sometimes, though, be just a different way of just squeezing money and viewership out of a franchise that's been a winner?
It can, but I think the ways that it will not be that are generally the ways in which you find filmmakers and storytellers who are operating outside of a profit-driven kind of model. So at the end of the day, what I'm really thinking about and I'm finding really curious about this is the idea that you've got filmmakers, in particular indie filmmakers, who are operating in this realm now, and they can understand that, yeah, we've always been about character-driven stories, but can we do them, you know, on the big screen and also on the small screen and find an audience? And I think that's the more intriguing aspect of what will come out of this, because if you do that, then you're not necessarily worried about how much money you're going to make or how much more you can squeeze out of a particular property. You're just going to be there thinking, wow, there's a great story that hasn't been told yet in this world, and I want to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about some of the titles that you have in your essay, starting with Rings of Power. My husband and I loved Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings movies, and we were so excited to see this whole thing was coming. But explain, for people who aren't the giant nerds that we are, explain what this series is about.
Yeah, this series basically looks at Sauron, the big bad of the Lord of the Rings books and those films, and sort of says, well, wait a minute, I guess that was the third age of Middle Earth. Who and what was he like in the previous age? So the Rings of Power takes us back to that second age. It also takes us back to before we knew who Gandalf was, before we knew who or what hobbits were. And we get to see all of these characters that we've known and loved from the Peter Jackson series. We get to see them kind of early on, how did they evolve and develop into the communities that they would become and have the impact that they would have in the Lord of the Rings. And more importantly, yeah, what was Sauron like? Who was he? Like, we've never, again, if you think about it, in the Lord of the Rings films, he's a mysterious figure. We almost don't see him at all. He's a giant eye And that's the scary eye that's keeping an eye out over all of Middle Earth. This dude wasn't an eye the entire time. Who was he? What was he like? What did he have to do? How did he develop this plan to devise the rings and put it all together? And that's what the series is doing for us. And it's fascinating to be able to go back. And again, sometimes it can be a little tedious because, again, yeah, you're talking about, you know, again, 8 episodes a season. They're talking about doing multiple seasons. We've already had 2 so far. I think there are at least 3 more from what I've heard that they're expecting to tend to put out. So there's a lot more story to tell in that universe, but it's also interesting because the story that they're telling is not necessarily based on a particular book. Tolkien wrote massive books with footnotes and subheadings and appendices and all of this stuff. So they're using all of that collected information to try to figure out how to pull these stories together, which is, again, another really weird and incredible feat in and of itself. Like, they're basically building whole seasons of the show off of footnotes.
Yeah, and almost like an archaeological dig or something.
Right, you know? Which tells you that that world was really dense in the first place. And that, yeah, there are probably going to be even more unexplored pieces of it than what we're even going to see by the time we get to the end of the Rings of Power.
Well, I've watched every episode of this. My husband has too. It's beautiful to watch. There's clearly a lot of money going into this production. But the story isn't always easy to follow. I don't mean to sound like a hater, but the characters don't always seem fully formed. At least that's what I think. What did you think? I mean, there have been lots of Lord of the Rings fans who have not been super excited about these series.
There have been, and I kind of get some of that. I think part of the problem is, again, when you are trying to delve into and expand a universe like that, if you don't have a very strict blueprint to draw from, you end up making things up. And they have had to do a lot of that in this process. So, yeah, not having a clear blueprint has potentially damaged people who, again, are really faithful fans of the books and the earlier films, who are kind of like, well, wait a minute, this doesn't feel like this other thing. But I think we also have to recognize that there's a reason why it doesn't feel like that other thing, because they are creating this, and we have to give them a little grace and hope that along the way they will figure it out and get a better handle on it so that they can move more confidently through that storytelling process that they're setting up.
Yeah, this is radio proof that you're just a nicer person than I am, I guess. some of this, I think, is kind of a risk with these Tolkien books because, I mean, Peter Jackson created these amazing movies, Lord of the Rings, all these movies from these giant books. But then The Hobbit was this kind of short book, and it spawned a lot of movies. There was a lot of criticism of that, too. I mean, is there just too much temptation to kind of milk this over and over again and stretch it out?
I think sometimes, yes, that is definitely the case. I mean, did we need 3 films based on The Hobbit? Probably not. And yeah, that gets to a point where, yeah, even someone like Peter Jackson, who we really respect as a storyteller and a filmmaker, I don't know that he was necessarily worried about the profit motive in that as much, but he was definitely concerned about, well, wait a minute. There's so, again, even in a short book, there's so much in there in the written text that he's like, I just really want to make sure that I get it all right. So there's a huge responsibility that he shoulders as part of that. And if you're the studio behind him as he's trying to figure it out, you know how much money you made with him before, you're probably going to be a little more inclined to sort of say, okay, well, yeah, if you need to do an extra one, it's all right. We can figure that out, because they're, you know, cha-ching in through all of the dollar signs and the sales, and they're thinking, okay, yeah, if, you know, 3 films out of 1 small book makes us look really good.
Yeah. I'm talking with film critic T.T. Stern-Enzi about some of the new adaptations available to stream. Let's talk about The Penguin. This series picks up where the 2022 movie The Batman left off. Talk a little bit about this, and how does this series about Gotham City work without Batman?
Yeah, that's what's so fun about the Penguin series, because, yeah, Colin Farrell plays the Penguin in the Batman film. He's a minor character. You know, it's almost forgettable in a way. He's in there for a few moments. He has a couple of exchanges with the Batman, and then he kind of disappears, and the rest of the story takes over, and you have the flooding of Gotham and all of the issues that come up, and the idea that it takes all of that for the Batman to realize, wait a minute, I can't be this figure of vengeance anymore. I need to provide hope. And boom, movie ends. This series picks up where the Penguin starts to recognize that there's a power vacuum in terms of the crime families in the city. He's been a bit player. He wants to step up. He wants more power, more control. And over the course of 8 episodes, we see him very methodically build himself up. We also get a little bit of his backstory, too, how he became the person that he is, both in the film and the series. And it's really fascinating, and it sets up the idea that by the time you get to the end of the series, we are ready for the next film. And you know that when we have the next film, there will be a villain in that. Maybe not include the Penguin in a large role there either. But what may come after that next film is we will get another series that may not focus on the Penguin either, because Batman has this incredible rogues gallery of characters that they can draw from, and they're trying to ground them and make them more, you know, gritty and realistic characters to go along with this really, really gritty and kind of disturbing vision of Gotham City. So, yeah, you're going to have more opportunities to explore and add more characters and have them become who they need to become. And again, they can do this all while Batman is always looming, but he doesn't have to make an appearance.
Hmm.
And there's some genius in that.
Yeah. Well, and I have to confess, I haven't watched this. I mean, do you like it? It's been critically acclaimed. Is this a case where it really works to kind of flesh out this character? Or is this just another way to just squeeze money out of the Batman franchise? Because my goodness, we've seen a lot of Batman stuff.
No, this really works. I mean, episode after episode, I was transfixed by the idea of looking at the Penguin character and thinking, well, somewhere in there, there's Colin Farrell is like lurking.
Like, buried under all those prosthetics.
We can barely see him, but when you listen to him, even though the accent is different and everything else, there's a little hint of, wait a minute, I know that voice. And you know it's him, and it's fascinating to watch. And it's not just him. All of the characters in the series have their moments. And you kind of recognize, wait a minute, this is one of those things where you've got a very character-driven world and, you know, showrunners who understand this is the way to really get into that world and into those characters. So it doesn't feel like a cash grab. It feels really authentic. I'm not sure that I would go so far as a lot of critics have talked about this as if it's like The Sopranos. I see and understand where they're coming from with that. It's not that. It is definitely comic book based, but it is gritty and real and interesting in a completely different way. But if it takes people knowing that it's on HBO and Max and they want to have that Sopranos kind of thing in you know, viewers' heads, it's probably not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, we've got to talk about Dune Prophecy. I know how much you love Dune. This series is kind of a prequel of sorts, as I understand. Explain when this story occurs and what it's about.
Yeah, this one, I mean, again, everybody who's ever heard me talk about Dune knows that I live in that world. And in essence, the whole Dune saga, if you can even call it a saga, probably spans tens of thousands of years. So in the first two films that Villeneuve gave us, he gave us the first book, which was looking at Paul Atreides and how he becomes this Masonic figure in his universe. And then all of a sudden, Dune Prophecy takes us back 10,000 years before he was born to look at the Bene Gesserit, who are sort of, they're called witches, and they're not witches at all. They are really more, they're a group, an order of women who have figured out how, using the spice, to make themselves superhuman.
They're like super nuns.
Yeah, they are. They're super nuns. They can, you know, use the power of the voice to get you to do what they want you to do. They can kind of read your mind and read your body language. They have this really great sign language that they use to communicate with each other because they're all about kind of controlling and amassing power in the Imperium. But what we're seeing in Dune Prophecy is the very beginning of that group. They're not even, they don't even have the name Bene Gesserit at this stage. They're just an order of women who are trying to figure out how to maintain and develop more power for themselves. But it is fascinating because in pretty much anything else you see as we talk about these kinds of properties in the franchises, they're Easter eggs. So there are hints and moments where, in this case, Dune as a planet is probably never going to be featured in the series. But they talk about Dune because, again, the spice that they use to acquire their abilities comes from that planet and the sandworms. So like Batman, Dune is not there, but it's always there.
Yeah, kind of looming.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched this. I heard an NPR interview with the two lead actresses who were terrific. They referred to this as 10,000 years BC before Chalamet.
Yes, so, yes.
It has these high-profile actors in the lead roles. Do you think this is something Dune fans are going to want to watch?
Well, as a Dune fan, I was dying to see this. It doesn't have the same sort of scale and scope that you would expect from the feature film. I mean, again, those huge vistas and, you know, the big battles and things like that. You're missing all of that. But you don't need it because for the story that it's trying to tell, it is still a big world, but it is smaller in that it's like palace intrigue in a way. And how do you handle, you know, manipulating people to get them to do what you want to do. It's like Game of Thrones, I guess, except it's in space and you've got worms instead of dragons, whatever else you want to do with that. But I think it works really, really well. And again, part of the issue with this that separates it from our earlier conversation about Lord of the Rings, they have the source material already. Dune Prophecy is based on, you know, the Sisterhood of Dune, which was all about the rise of the Bene Gesserit. There are other books that deal with the Navigators and the Mentets, and again, I'm saying things that no one else probably knows about in the world. But all of those groups and factions that are part of the Dune universe have their own stories. So at some point in time, we're getting this. We'll get another feature film that will take and more than likely follow the second book that Frank Herbert wrote. But then they know they can always come back to some of these other stories to help round out that world and make it a more immersive experience for everyone.
Well, your essay also has a section labeled Complications. It talks about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which you write is struggling right now. What's the struggle?
I think the struggle for Marvel is curious because it's an overabundance of stories. You know, if we, again, how this conversation has gone so far, The Lord of the Rings had a finite number of books, even with all the appendices and everything else, still a finite number of books. Dune has all of these books that you can then use to, okay, here, we can make films out of these, we can make shows out of this. Marvel has so many stories and so many different timelines and versions of characters. It's a little, not a little, it's an incredibly overwhelming kind of universe to put together. Which character do you use? Which version of the character are you going to use in terms of trying to tell stories? And I think they've hit the wall where they're just like, oh my God, like we don't know what to do anymore. And there's not a unifying voice that's handling that process. They may have a unifying producer in Feige, Kevin Feige, but he's not laying out an outline or a blueprint for what they're supposed to do. And you have so many filmmakers and so many different showrunners, and everybody is kind of given the opportunity to like, okay, this is your project, but it may have to connect and have a teaser for another project over here or a film or whatever else. but it's never clearly defined. So everybody's kind of operating in their bubble, but then their bubble can attach to another piece or it may not attach to a piece. And it's just, it leads to one big ball of confusion.
The latest spinoff was Agatha All Along. I have to confess, I started to watch this. I was really tired. I fell asleep. So I don't mean that as a criticism to Agatha. I think that, you know, it's gotten some love from critics, I thought. What's the premise of this show? Have you watched it? What do you think of it?
I have watched it. It's kind of the follow-up, if you will, to WandaVision. Agatha now.
Which was great. WandaVision was great.
WandaVision was great, but part of WandaVision's problem as well is it was a really neat idea with the whole sitcom over the course of every decade kind of thing like that. That was an interesting hook, but then what's the payoff for it? So you get to the end of the series and you're kind of like, I don't know if this all really made sense. And yet, Agatha comes out of this. It's about her trying to get her powers back, trying to figure out, you know, how to move on with her life. There are other characters who are also dealing with the same things. And I think the problem with this is, is it supposed to relate to something else? Is it going to take us to a feature film? Is it going to take us to another series? And by the time you get to the end, I don't know that they knew where this was going to go and how it would connect either. So it ends, but we don't know what's going to come next. We just know that something is going to come next because it's Marvel.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, I have been talking with film critic T.T. Stern Enzi. You can find his latest essay on our website, wvxu.org. TT, our producer, Selena Reeder, says that Catwoman needs her own series. Could you put in a word with your friends in Hollywood? Other than that, thanks so much for your time.
I'm glad to be here, and I'll see what I can do about that.
Okay. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.